Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. American writers and activists James Baldwin and Toni Morrison said throughout their lives that racism is a white problem and it will not change until white people see how it hurts them. Being White Today, a roadmap for positive anti-racist life, offers insight that the problem of systemic racism can only be addressed when white people understand that it's their problem too. The authors, Shelley Tuchluk and Christine Saxman, issue an invitation to white people to talk about race with one another in ways that lead to systemic change. In recent elections and the election of 2024, it will not be any different. The idea that white people are under attack permeates political discourse. The book acknowledges the complexities and challenges that come with being white in a racially diverse society and encourages readers to confront their own biases and privileges. Christine, I welcome you to 411 Teen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Christine Saxman, co-author, founded Saxman Consulting, where she provides racial and social justice training, facilitation, and coaching for educational, corporate, not-for-profit, and government organizations. She also works on the staff of National SEED Project, Seeking Education, Equity, and Diversity. Again, Christine, thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us. What inspired you to co-write Being White Today? I mean, it was involved a personal journey. Just what was it that inspired you to do so?
Well, truly there was one moment. I was a high school teacher in the classroom, and I had been doing a college essay exercise with my seniors. I worked in a predominantly white district in Illinois and was doing what I thought was a low stakes exercise with my teens, getting ready for, you know, the college essay prep. And we had listened to an essay or an online, actually radio program, about someone who, an Indian American woman who had been in a school that was predominantly white and had everyone write the essay about diversity about her. And one of my students who was white said, "I'm so sick of this school making me feel guilty about being white. I'm ready to join the alt-right, and I'm Jewish." And they were in small groups and working together, and everyone in the classroom heard him. And so I kind of walked over and, you know, joined his group, and I just said, "Tell me more about the school making you feel guilty about being white." And at that moment, as someone who had been on my school's racial equity team and had been doing my own journey about being white and doing anti-racist work, I just knew there was something that we were missing as anti-racist people helping white people, if that's what my white student was getting from the work. Mm-hmm. And I was really worried about what it meant for white students to be drawn to the alt-right. So this was back in 2016, so even before Charlottesville and the Unite the Right rally. And I just knew that we needed to do more about providing models for what it meant to be white to white people, so that the alt-right and the white nationalists didn't get to own what it meant to be white, and that anti-racists needed to do a better job, that it wasn't just about guilt and shame about what it meant to be white, that we could be white and anti-racist and that it could be okay.
Well, define whiteness for the listening audience. You know, define it because it's very important that white people understand the concept.
Yeah. So in the book, we really help and try to slow down and understand the difference between white people, white culture, and whiteness.
Okay.
And whiteness is when white culture becomes that very oppressive thing that makes white culture be the best and only for everybody. And so in a school, knowing as a white person, I'm a white person, that I could teach my culture and just say it's the best for everybody. And that means it's the best for everybody, meaning for my students of color, as well as my white students. And that's when it becomes oppressive. And it's okay for me to be proud of my white culture and love the things that I enjoy about being white. Except when I do that thing, which is make it the best and only for everyone. And that is what we try to say about whiteness. And whiteness then becomes that white supremacy culture, white supremacy, which we see in the history of our country, that then white nationalists now keep trying to do.
Okay. All right. White people engaging in anti-racism work face common challenges and forms of resistance. You have a long history of engaging in anti-racism. Can you talk some about the common challenges or forms of resistance that you have encountered?
Well, I think, one, I want to just acknowledge that, so as a white person doing this work, the resistance that I face is very different than the work that the people of color, the Black and brown folks who've been doing this for a very long time. And I think that you know, when you opened and spoke about James Baldwin and Toni Morrison, I want to acknowledge that Shelley and I are doing this work because of our mentors of color. And so that resistance is nothing new in particular for folks of color who've been leading the resistance. And so it's different for folks of color than it is for white folks.
Oh, I'm sure we know that. I'm Black.
I know. Okay. And I know.
You know, so I don't expect it to be the same, you know, but I want to know. Only reason I ask is because from your perspective, how do you see, you know, what are you seeing? Because I think that's the only way that we will ever come together. We may never sing Kumbaya, but at least if we have understanding and better insight, and I think that that's a way that we get there, is just by educating each other. I don't know.
And I think, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, I don't know. It just seems like that's real important, that I don't have to agree with you. That's not the key. But I need to be able to understand where you're coming from and vice versa. Because if we don't, I don't see how we can go forward.
Yeah. And I think the resistance to white people talking to white people is different than folks of color talking to white people. And I think that's the piece of when we're talking about what does it look like for a healthy multiracial democracy, which is ultimately that what we want in this awkward and sometimes strange American experiment that has not yet succeeded. And I think that's the piece of what Shelley and I want to offer, is the American ideals that many white Americans hold to and get very attached to, that sometimes works for them and often hasn't worked for folks of color, is where the mismatch in communication happens in cross-racial relationship. And so I think that's what I was saying when, for us, what resistance looks like, meaning us, meaning Shelley and I, is different than when we're doing cross-racial work. that the resistance for white folks talking to white folks is.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you totally. You don't even have to go any further. No, I'm just teasing, but I know what you're saying. Yes, ma'am. Go on. Continue.
Is that we're breaking with a little bit of we're not supposed to talk about these things outside of we're not supposed to talk about it. We're not supposed to talk about being white, first of all, because we're supposed to be colorblind on one side.
Oh, God, we have to talk about that. Are you? Does that help anything?
No,
colorblind doesn't help. I mean, we'll get to that. It does not. I don't think it helps. I think colorblind is the opposite. I mean, you need to be able to see color. You need to be able to see differences. How can you appreciate if you can't see the differences?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm hoping it's not. The things I'm saying are just too foreign to you. But I mean, whenever I hear the word colorblind, I'm like, that's not the goal. But
no.
I know you're not coming from there. So don't. I'm not trying to even say that. But you know, when I hear people, oh, well, I'm colorblind. I don't see color. Oh, please. Okay.
I know. Oh. And this is the thing: is that unfortunately, white folks have convinced themselves that if they say that, that this will actually help them in cross-racial relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they don't understand when people like you are like
react like I do,
and they're like, "But wait, I thought this was going to help me."
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why Shelly and I are like, well, no, and here's why, because you're erasing someone's identity. You're erasing someone's experience. And so, yes, race hasn't mattered for you as a white person because the history has catered to you in your white identity, but they've never thought about themselves as having a white identity. And that's why in the book we offer, you've never had to think about this. And this is why we say white people's work to work with other white people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's our job to help other white people think about this. We're not asking folks of color to do this, but we want to help other white people do it so that we can get to the point when you realize like, oh, okay. And as Dr. Helms, who's the Black psychologist who offers the white identity framework that we use in the book.
Hold your thoughts right there. We're going to take a break real quickly and we'll get right back at you. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and I am talking with Christine Saxman. She is co-author of Being White Today, A Roadmap for Positive Anti-Racist Left. Christine, I had to interrupt you. My apologies. Continue, please.
Yes. So Dr. Janet Helms is the Black psychologist from Boston College who created White Identity Framework. She was the woman who said, white people don't seem to understand what's, to your point earlier about color blindness, why is that? And so she psychologically studied it. And she's the person who really helped both Shelly and I to understand our own identities as white people so that we could then help other white people. So when white people are struggling with color blindness, why is that? And then Shelly and I then followed her lead to figure out how can we offer tips and tools and strategies so that we can help shepherd more and more white people through that status, through those earlier psychological statuses when they're struggling, so that we can get them to a point where they see why race does matter. Mm-hmm. They can see the racism and what she calls the moral dilemmas. This ideal that we have about this United States that we live in, which does, you know, work for white folks often, not always, but often, and then it doesn't work for folks of color. And those are the moral dilemmas that white people wrestle with. And then they ultimately have a choice to decide, am I going to ignore that moral dilemma and kind of like erase it, or am I going to choose what we hope is anti-racism and then move into a healthy, positive anti-racist life.
Okay. What is your take on this rash of books on anti-racism? I mean, there's a lot of them out there. I mean, I think in the last year, I probably talked about two or three. I don't know if they were fueled by the George Floyd or the Breonna Taylors or the Ahmaud Arbery. But what distinguishes your book from other anti-racism books out there?
I do believe what makes our book different is we are wrestling with white racial identity and the ways in which white people have to navigate that recruitment from white nationalists, mm-hmm. and the ways in which white nationalists want to get more white people on their side, and the ways that anti-racists sometimes come a white anti-racists, let me be clear, come a little hard and heavy at white people who are a little confused and like trying their best. To your point, when George Floyd was murdered and a lot of white people showed up and they were clunky because they hadn't paid attention before. And, you know, for good reasons, bad reasons, all the reasons. And they showed up. And there were a lot of white people who, anti-racist white people who were, for the lack of a better word, were judgmental and mm-hmm. kind of came at them. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up having this fight rather than embracing. And I think that fight was under the guise of accountability rather than realizing like these folks, yes, they were late to the party. Yes, all those things are true and they're here now. And we could have been more receptive using the psychological model that Dr. Helms offered to shepherd them forward. And we ended up pushing them out again, mm-hmm. which is why, you know, 4 years later, a lot of those white people are no longer around.
Mm-hmm. For the listening audience, how do you define anti-racism?
Well, I think we can look to a lot of the models from Dr. Kendi, you know, mm-hmm. to go back to your points to the scholars who came before Toni Morrison and James Baldwin. I think it's just being active to trying to end racism. And it's that active piece. It's taking current action.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I would agree with that. I don't have any problem with that. I think the doctrine probably, I mean, it rejects the whole white supremacy of one racial group over another and promotes racial equality. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Why is the conversation about racism so difficult? I mean, no one's born racist or anti-racist. It's learned. All of us learned. It's a choice we make. Mm-hmm. You know, whether we're conscious or unconscious, but it's a choice we make. Okay? Would you agree with that? I'm just trying to make you know see where we are.
Yes.
Okay.
I think there's the layer of a lack of history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also think there's a lack of skill, critical thinking skill.
Yeah. But you know, that makes you look at the schools. Because what role do the schools play? Because they don't encourage or foster critical thinking, in my opinion. I know I'm getting kind of...
Well, I think, yes. And I think that that's part of where we're seeing right now, mm-hmm. this point in history, to talk about the importance of history, where we're seeing laws actually being passed that are prioritizing the comfort of some racial groups over others in some states in our country, and the prohibition of the teaching of some people's history over others by racial groups. And that is comforting white folks. And so that goes back to the history where we see this is not a new pattern. This is not new. So to go back to what you said before about putting some people over the others, like that has been the history of our country of prioritizing white people.
Sometimes, often, let me just say this. Confronting racism could be about changing the systems. You could say it's just changing the systems, whether it's the educational system or the healthcare system, the criminal justice, you know, we can go on and on, property, whatever. But systems, in turn, are made up of individuals and of groups. And, you know, these systems are held in place by all these crazy myths and narratives that about people, who they are and what they do. So if we want to change the system, we have to look at how, the role the individuals play. And once we see that role, we see how the system actually lives in them. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And that's,
yes. And that's one of the things that we offer in the book is we hold very closely to a both and way of thinking. We have to think about both the systems and the individuals within the system. We have to approach both. And if we don't, we fall prey to either or, which is right. Part of how we got into the fix that we're in.
Yes, and I do commend you on your book. I mean, I thought it was well written and succinct, and I liked the format of it, particularly how at the back of each chapter or several chapters, I don't know. You know, you had a summary, and I liked how you broke the summary down. I mean, because I think that people have to be able to grasp what's happening and that there is a disconnect between how one interprets it and another one interprets it, that be a person of color or a white person.
Yes.
Okay. All right. But I did like your book. I wanted you to know that. Okay. Oh, gosh, why or maybe what is the barrier that white people and black, brown, whatever, face when it comes to discussing race? I mean, have you figured that out? Because it seems like whenever you start talking about race, people start tiptoeing around it. And I'm just wondering, have you figured out a way? I know your book is just for white people, but, you know, you've had a lot of experience in working with anti-racist doctrines and positions. So I'm picking your brain.
Sure. So I'll offer a couple things. Okay. I mean, So to talk about my community first, I think white people get, fear is the first one. So white folks get completely paralyzed by, I don't want to offend anyone, or I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to, you know, so there's that piece when that white silence takes over. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one part. Or they've had the experience when they they get one piece of feedback. You know, you've heard the term white fragility. Mm-hmm. They get one piece of feedback, and then that's the thing that sends them, well, I'm never going to say anything again because, you know, I said one thing once.
I know. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, for my community, I think that's often the thing in cross-racial space. Now, listen, mm-hmm. I'm also going to be clear that they have a lot to say when they're among white people.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they do.
You know, and that's
in word included.
Yes. You know, and I think, you know, that's when I'm breaking with white racial solidarity, because I'm not supposed to say that. Mm-hmm. and we do, you know, and that's the irony of the, you know, oh no, I don't see color. And yet when I'm among white people who think there's no one who's paying attention or isn't going to break that white solidarity, you know, they have lots to say. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in my cross-racial work, of course, I understand why folks of color don't want to trust white people because of exactly what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the history bears out, why would you trust white people? Why would folks of color trust white people? Unless we've shown we can be trustworthy.
Right. Good point. I mean, the other side of that, or right next to it, is this problem, this issue, this white supremacist attitude affects everybody. It affects blacks, it affects browns, and it affects whites. We can't effectively confront racism without white people truly recognizing themselves and accepting the roles that they play. And they may not be conscious, I'm not saying that, but they've got to have a real control of where they are. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and I think that confuses white people sometimes. And mm-hmm. we talk about this in the book. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we are the ones, white folks, who benefit from racism. And then we get super confused when we see folks of color who say racism doesn't matter. And especially when then we can say, like, when we see other white people say, so see, this person of color says racism doesn't matter. And then we see someone like Enrique Terrio, we talk about in the book, who mm-hmm. was a head of the Proud Boys. And there's, you know, more
and a person of color.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, well, so see, racism doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And so then when we have to talk about, to go back to your earlier question about whiteness. So whiteness is a consciousness. It's not a skin color.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that it operates is if I can try to get some power by getting close to this consciousness, even though it's going to eventually do harm to me and my skin color. Mm-hmm. And white folks are like, I don't understand how that mm-hmm. operates. Until I've done some deep work and we can see how it plays out eventually. But that takes that critical thinking piece. So that's that nuance. And I think that that's the hard part in a society that likes, like, the soundbite, the mm-hmm. quick
clickbait.
the clickbait.
Yeah.
We have to slow down and have a hard conversation of so what does it mean that whiteness says, even though it's ultimately going to benefit white people, it still could seduce folks of color to come along mm-hmm. and support it,
mm-hmm.
even if it's working ultimately against their own benefit. And to be clear, I just want to be super clear, whiteness is working, I believe, against my benefit as well as a white person, because I believe in a multiracial, healthy multiracial future. But that's another complex idea that we have to actually think about and slow down to think about.
Mm-hmm. And in many ways you have addressed this, but where does one start on the journey? What can they do?
Where does one start? Gosh, no one's asked me that in a long time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, thank you for that question. I do believe that one starts in relationships. I do think that, I love the work of someone like Bryan Stevenson when he talks about proximity and just getting to know people who are different than you are. So that's for white folks, that's for folks of color. And I do think that doing that work while you're also learning about yourself, which is why we offer white folks, I have to believe that I have a racial identity, because too many white people believe that race is about people of color. Like, I don't have a race.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, under this, social construction, I do. And I have to understand that. In order to have healthy cross-racial relationships, I have to understand that.
Right.
I have, even if I grew up in an all-white neighborhood with all-white teachers, I was still learning things about race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that right there answers what I was getting ready to ask you next. And I'm just going to throw it out there, and then we'll go and we'll have a break and we'll come back. But what have you learned on this journey? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollifield. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
Christine, what have you learned on the journey?
I think what I have learned is about that piece that I was saying now that I truly have cross-racial relationships that are mutually reciprocal. And so by that, I mean, I know that I have learned some stuff about myself as a white person and that it has value, and that I had to do that so that I just wasn't learning. And I'll say this in kind of a needy way from my friends of color, so that race was just about them, so that I could show up in my own racial identity and I had something to offer.
What has been the response of friends, associates, folks who have read your book? How has it been received?
I think one of the best stories that I can tell you is I have a Japanese American friend who lives in the Pacific Northwest, who started putting the book in little libraries in the predominantly white neighborhoods that surround her. And she just, would put it there and leave a note that said, please read this book. And, if you find it valuable, share it with someone else, and maybe get another copy and share it with someone else. And she shared a copy of the book that had a beautiful inscription that said, I've read this and it's so important. And I really think I would ask you to read it and share it and get a copy and share it with someone else. And I feel like those little ways of white people sharing with white people is important And also recognizing that it's our relationships with folks of color that is that healthy multiracial society that we're working towards, that we're not there yet, because you know, democracy is under threat and racism is still here. And that's what we're working towards.
What role do the youth of today play? And I ask that because I see them as a major change factor. You know, we look at this book burning and curriculum reform, and we do live in a fascist system that's embracing the denial of history and denial of reality. A system that calls slavery involuntary relocation. What role do you think that youth play and can play today in this?
Well, as a former high school teacher,
yes, I that's why I asked you. I thought when you said that, I was like, oh, I need to ask her.
Yes. Thank you for asking me, because I just believe in one, they already have so much capacity. Seeing their ability to work as change agents, even as high school students and young people, you know, college students, you know, we can see that what they're doing on college campuses right now, I think is really important. And so I really do believe in their ability to create change. And I think I get frustrated sometimes with elders who get super critical of young people. You know, they haven't lived enough yet. They don't have enough experience. And I think we have to do a both and, as you know, we really embrace both and. I think, yes, experience is important, and we have to listen to the wisdom of youth. And I appreciate cultures who really value the wisdom of youth. And so, you know, I want to say to your young listeners that they need to trust themselves and they need to believe in themselves. And I want them to resist the voices who tell them that they don't know enough or that they can't trust themselves. They need to lean into the both and of yes, they need their elders and they need to listen to intergenerational wisdom, and they have something to bring to the table.
I want to ask you this, and before I ask, I'm not being offensive or sarcastic. Why does it matter to you? I mean, you could go on your merry way and, you know.
I have come to the point where I believe that as a white person, my humanity is tied up in this work. Like, I cannot thrive if everyone is not thriving. And I truly believe that. I believe this work isn't a choice. To go back, I guess, to what you said earlier, like, it was a choice to start, and now it's no longer a choice.
Okay. Well, you know, in this, with where we are, no system or person is untouched by white supremacy. What is your response to that comment when you hear it?
I believe that, and I believe that many people who are white are so socialized they can't see it. And so that's my part of my work, and what the book is to help white people see that.
Okay. Are they seeing it? Do they want, you know, you got to want to see it too, though.
Well, and I mean,
you
think
got
that's
to have some desire to reach out, because if you don't, it won't happen.
Yeah. And I think that that's what Helen's work has helped me to see, is that they can't see it, they can't until they are willing to see that systemic racism also impacts them. And I think that's what, like, my answer to you when you ask me, you know, do I have a choice anymore? I don't believe so, because I believe white supremacy is actually killing all of us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I do believe that. Now, I don't think most white people do. And I believe that I can get more white people to believe that. I also don't believe it's easy.
Yeah, I would agree with you. We kind of touched on this when we were talking, and I wanted to further explore it. We were talking about ignorance and fear, because we always hear that ignorance and fear are the roots of racism. And Ibram Kendi has somewhat of a different understanding, in that those in power, how should I say this? Those in power use racism to justify their policies, you know, while wielding kind of emotive power of ignorance and hate to keep it going.
Yeah.
Okay. So I, you know, my question was just, where do you sit on that position, as they use these tools of ignorance and hate that are there, they use those at their disposal? Because they're powerful. I mean, look at what's happening now.
Well, and I think that that's the difference that I see, is those in power are the, like, have the awareness of it, but what mm-hmm. they're activating, mm-hmm. those don't have the awareness and power. And I think that's what the difference I make between the white folks. I have more empathy for white folks who are responding to dog whistles than the people calling the dog whistles, is what I will say.
Okay.
So Candy's, you know, when he's talking about the people in power who are calling the dog whistles, those are the people with the awareness. The people who are responding, they're not aware of what they're responding to. And so the folks, I have much more compassion for the folks responding to the dog whistles than I do for the folks calling them.
Mm-hmm. What does racial equity look like?
Well, equity to me is very much about responding to what folks need,
mm-hmm.
and being really clear about what the history has been. And that means, to go back to the critical thinking, we have to really understand our history and the differential treatment of Indigenous, Native folks, Black, African folks, Mexican, you know, deported folks,
mm-hmm.
you know, Chinese, Japanese folks. You know, we can go through the whole history of folks of color who've been mistreated in this country. Versus white European folks. And so we have to be aware of that as we talk about what equity really means.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the clock and I'm like, wow, where did the time go? Please tell my listening audience where they can get your book. That's what we're supposed to be talking about. Please tell them, and if you all have a website or whatever, how they can follow you, or, you know.
You can get the book anywhere books are sold, your local bookstore, anywhere. You can visit us at Being White Today. You can find us on social media. Yes, please visit us any of those places.
Okay, say that again a little slower. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
For those who, you know, they may be trying to write it down.
Yes, thank you. Okay. Please visit us at beingwhitetoday.com. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, or sorry, X, I guess it's called now. Mm-hmm. Although we're not super active there. Instagram, and please, anywhere books are sold.
Okay. In these last few minutes, we got a few minutes. I wanted to talk about a little bit more about the impact of white supremacy, because I see the key with white supremacists is just recognizing that the system is broken. Another way of looking at it, and another twist. It was never designed, we were talking about equity and we went off break, but it was never designed for equity of anything, not in education, not in healthcare, opportunity, employment. So we got to understand that the system is broken and that there is a built-in bias and discrimination and prejudice, you know, and that we have, that's what we have to at least be aware of. Be aware of that and then take the step to right those wrongs. Would you agree with that? And what is the takeaway you intend for your book?
Well, I think to your
I asked you two questions.
to your first point, I think we have to acknowledge that a system that wasn't designed for everyone was already broken. Mm-hmm. And so it has to be repaired or maybe redesigned. And so that goes to the acknowledgement of, I don't even know if it's a both and. Is it broken or was it?
It never was right.
Exactly. Was right. It always just messed up?
Yeah.
So I think that's the piece of, you know, maybe we do need to start from scratch. And I think that riles a lot of white folks up who are very attached to the ideals that I was talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that means that's the work that my folks need to do with each other. Because just because it worked for you doesn't mean mm-hmm. we don't need to like redesign. That's part of the reckoning with the moral dilemmas of what it means to be in a multiracial democracy. And so I think that ties actually directly mm-hmm. to your second question. So what is my hope for the book is that it actually helps white folks not get so activated that you can't just be with that question. And if you truly believe that this country, this ideal was meant to be for everyone, truly for everyone, racially, and all the identities, then we have work to do. And it's not scary work. It's hard work, but it's not scary work. We can do it, and we can do it together.
In a minute, that's all I can give you. We didn't talk about self-reflection, and I think that that's emphasized in your book. And just wanted to know if you had some effective methods or exercises for white people to critically examine their own biases and privileges.
I think my biggest one, I will just say in that short time, is to not do it alone. Do it with other folks. Seek out models. Mm-hmm. And just keep making progress. That's all. It's not scary. Just do it.
Any words of wisdom that you'd like to leave us with? And I think about that, and I think because you've been in the school system, do you have any suggestions for them?
Well, I want to go back to, again, I just really want young people to believe in yourselves. You have more power than you know. And just believe in that and take action with each other, intergenerationally, and you can make change. Believe that.
Well, I would like to really commend you. I really enjoyed your book. I think it was well done. So appreciation are high for what you are doing, okay? To my listening audience, it's about that time. We're always running out of time for this edition of 411 Teen. I have been talking with author of Being White Today, A Roadmap for a Positive Anti-Racist Life, Christine Saxman. Again, Christine, thank you for sharing your experiences and your expertise and your energy. To my listening audience, much appreciation for your time and your ear. Get the 411 on 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens, families, and other interested folks. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, inviting you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at WFSU.org.